Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. It's the end of another week, and this one in America has a long holiday ahead of us, a long weekend. We have Memorial Day coming up on Monday, and that's a good reminder to us that we need to make certain this is not just about some kind of holiday, but it's a ceremonial observance to remember the price that has been paid in the lives of American soldiers, sailors, and airmen. Americans in uniform, and Memorial Day has a long historical heritage and an important part of our national culture, and it is important that this generation, maybe it's especially important that this generation remember what is at stake. The cover story in this week's issue of Time magazine is another reminder that there are still noble Americans serving in uniform, some of our very best and brightest. The cover has three cadets from West Point. And inside is a fascinating article that really kind of recounts their story, how they got to West Point, what happened. These are three graduates of the class of 2005, and all three are, of course, now headed for service in the nation's Army. And West Point is one of those places that just has to make every American heart beat a little faster and a little prouder. There's just something about the tradition, something about the ambience and the culture of the place there in New York State that simply cries out American patriotism and American pride. There on that lawn at West Point, you know that most of the great generals and the great officers of the United States Army have paraded as cadets and have later come back to be honored. It was there at West Point that General Douglas MacArthur gave his very famous farewell address. And it is there that so many of America's great leaders have been forged. And it's a reminder that the kind of discipline required to create that quality of officer class is something beyond what most Americans could understand or endure. Now, according to Time, only 41 cadets of the class of 2005 were mustered out. 41. That is the lowest muster out rate in recent years, recent classes at West Point, we are told, because the discipline, the physical standards, everything that is required is just more than most American young people could ever have conceived. For instance, Time tells us that West Point is the kind of place, quote, where failure to have your books arranged by descending height on your desk can earn you hours of forced marching in the rain. And you thought you were tough. Other issues around the country demand our attention. In Broward County, Florida, news reports coming out just today of an arts controversy there. The Broward Art Guild, which is a private nonprofit organization, has moved from its prominent position a piece of art that is entitled Yahoo. It has led to controversy. County Administrator Roger Desjarlais said that a phone call was placed to the Broward Art Guild by Department Director Mary Becht. She is Director of the Department of Cultural Affairs, and this has led to an internal discussion, this according to the Sun Sentinel there in Fort Lauderdale. An internal discussion of whether county agencies have the right to influence artistic decisions or fund certain exhibitions. Now, the exhibition itself is entitled Controversy. That ought to be one little wake-up call that they should have expected controversy to follow. Guild Director Susan Bootsy said, "It's not every day you get a call from the Director of Cultural Affairs at your home. I took it very seriously. Why in the world was the call made? What was the call about? It has to do with one piece of art, this piece of art that is entitled Yahoo. A piece of art that depicts President Bush being sodomized." Artist Alfred Phillips said that images of an oil barrel and a man wearing a Muslim headdress in the work are part of a political statement about the United States being abused by oil companies. And let's just think about what we've got here. We have an art exhibition called Controversy that has within it a piece of controversial art about the President of the United States being sodomized, which is supposed to be a metaphor of America being abused by oil companies. We have a tax-supported art exhibition that led to one of the tax-supporting entities, the Department of Cultural Affairs in Broward County, Florida, to place a call about the controversy. This led the Broward Art Guild to move the piece of art not out of the display or out of the building altogether, but to put it around the corner where one had to see it with a little more intentionality. Well, you know exactly what's coming. This is censorship. That's what some are claiming right away, including Broward County Vice Mayor Ben Graber, who said as long as the art show placed disclaimers about the contents exhibit, county officials had no place making the phone call. Listen to what he had to say here. These are his words as recorded in the Fort Lauderdale Sun-Sentinel. If there's a warning at the door, the county should not be involved. I respect freedom of speech regardless of the issue. It's obviously a political message. I can't see why one should be allowed and not the other. Everyone should have the opportunity. Well, Mr. Vice Mayor Ben Graber, everyone didn't have the opportunity. Other pieces of art that are included in this display, 45 pieces of art, by the way, include pieces that depict President Bush dressed as the Statue of Liberty holding a tablet with a swastika on it. Another piece shows two American soldiers carrying a dead body into a car. And you're going to find this fascinating. One artist produced a piece showing Pope Benedict XVI with several swastikas in the background. Evidently, swastikas are in this particular exhibition in Broward County, Florida. Now, you're going to love this part. It was the artist who depicted Pope Benedict XVI with swastikas behind him who was offended by the piece of art showing President Bush being sodomized. And it was one artist who ratted on the other artist and said, a line has been crossed. Listen to this. This is one artist speaking of another. Quote, sodomy in a public forum is not, from my perspective, considered art. I think somebody has to draw the line somewhere. I like political satire. However, that kind of image, I don't think it's artistic. He said of himself, something snapped inside. Okay, let's just take this one apart for a minute. We have an artist who thought it was completely appropriate to depict Benedict XVI, the current Pope of the Roman Catholic Church, with swastikas in the background. That's art, supposedly. But he's offended by President George W. Bush being sodomized in a piece of art. I'm offended that we live in this kind of world. I'm offended that any of this is considered art. This is insanity masquerading as a serious political and artistic discussion. Why are tax monies going into this in the first place? If this is art, let the artist produce it, and then let the artist find someone who's willing to pay for it or willing to pay to come and see it. You see, the real fallacy in all of this is the statement made by the Broward County Vice Mayor, who says, if there's a warning at the door, the county should not be involved. The only true part of what he had to say are those last words, the county should not be involved. County tax dollars should not be involved in this kind of art exhibition. Why are we continually finding ourselves embroiled in these controversies when, after all, we shouldn't be involved in these art debates in the first place in terms of tax money? There is no shortage of money in this country to pay for art. There are rich people on both coasts and between the two coasts who are willing to spend incredible millions of dollars on art. Let them spend it. If it's private money, who's going to complain? If it's a private institution, someone has to buy a ticket to come see it, let them come see it. Who's going to complain? But if my tax dollars are involved in it, I have a right to complain. We'll see how this controversy unfolds in Broward County, Florida. I have to say that I grew up a good many of my years in Broward County, and I wish I could say I'm shocked and surprised by this. Speaking of being shocked and surprised, CBS News had a particularly interesting news broadcast. It was broadcast on May the 26th and had to do with a woman who was selling her services as a counterfeit essay writer for college entrance examinations. In this case, Nicole Crystal is her name. She said that she couldn't make a living making music in Hollywood, so she tried her hand at an older profession. She called it being an academic prostitute. She says, I mean, I sold my mind for money. Now, this is what's interesting. The clients who hired this woman weren't the kids, but their parents. That's right. That's what's happening in America right now. You have parents who are so insistent that they want to get little Bobby. I guess it's not Bobby anymore. It's Chad. To get Chad or to get Tiffany into the college, that they are willing to hire someone to write the essay. Now, in any other sphere of life, that is called fraud. We would recognize it for what it is. But this tells you something about what's happening in our meritocracy, where all of a sudden merit really doesn't matter if you can just go out and hire someone to write the essay for you. In Massachusetts, Governor Mitt Romney has vetoed a bill that would expand embryonic stem cell research. we need to note that this bill goes even further than the Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act of 2005 that was recently pushed through the House and is now before the Senate and will face a veto from President Bush. That bill before Congress would allow the destruction of human embryos that are now dormant in fertility clinics. That is a tragedy and an assault against human dignity. But in Massachusetts, by a margin that appears to be sufficient to override the governor's veto, this state government is actually going to fund cloned human embryos that will be created for the sole purpose of being destroyed through embryonic stem cell research. We come to the end of the week with an ominous note. This is what we're up against, folks. We'll be right back for a discussion you won't want to miss. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I want to tell you what we're going to talk about today, and I just want to give you an advance warning. No, it's not racy. It's not about sex. It's not about something that is intimate. It's about something that's far more controversial than that. It's about daycare, childcare, preschool. You know, a lot of Christians just shy away from any conversation about this because it can get so controversial and so close to home so fast. And what I hope we can do in the course of this program is start to think about how we ought to think about this issue and start a conversation that I'm sure will not be concluded today, but I hope we'll get a good start today. The catalyst for our discussion is a news story that was in the New York Times just last week. And it reported that as many as 5,000 children are now expelled from preschool programs each year. Now, take that seriously. 5,000 kids expelled from preschool. We know that kids get expelled from high school and middle school. They get thrown out of college. But what do you have to do to get expelled from preschool? Well, it's antisocial behavior. That's the new sociological descriptor. The New York Times says that researchers at the Yale Child Study Center conducted a study that indicated an expulsion rate for preschoolers that ran three times higher than rates for school-aged children. I'm reading from the report here. In the past, in a school of 150 kids, you might have one or two kids with behavior problems, but now it may be up to 10% of the kids. Now, a particular writer for the New York Times, in this case, Jennifer Steinhauer, suggested that maybe preschool is the problem. And when I saw that headline, I thought, you know, that's a real gutsy piece for the New York Times. That's going to raise a host of issues. But it was not as racy or as controversial as I thought it would be, because in her article, Maybe Preschool is the Problem, Jennifer Steinhauer wasn't really dealing with the existence of preschool, arguing that it was better for kids to be at home. She was rather arguing that we've turned preschool into a hyper-educational context when it ought to be more about playtime and socialization and all the rest. Her point was that we have expectations of these little kids they simply can't meet. We have behavioral and academic and learning expectations of preschoolers that, quite frankly, they're just not able to live up to. These are not young scholars. These are toddlers and preschoolers. They're learning how to talk to each other and how to play. They're not ready for pre-algebra. I want to raise a deeper issue. I want to ask a serious question. If we're having such problems in preschool, such that the New York Times decides it's worthy of news analysis, if the report coming out of Yale indicates that as many as 5,000 preschoolers are expelled for behavioral problems each year, if the rate of expulsion from preschools is three times that of school-aged children, what is that telling us? Now, I want to tell you, the controversy, the difficulty in discussing this is that when you talk about preschool, daycare, you talk about children outside the home, that inevitably raises the question of why the kid is there in the first place, why is the child not at home, and here is where the sensitivities come very fast. So I want to try to lay out an understanding, and I want to invite you to respond. So very quickly, here's the way I think we should frame the issue. Our task as Christians is not to just deal with sociological analysis and say, now what are we going to do about this? But is rather to go back to biblical and theological principles and try to think through how would God intend for us to order our lives? How would God intend for us to address the needs, the nurture, the care, the teaching, the protection of preschool children? In a world like this, how do we do the very best to match that model? I'm going to make a statement I believe with all of my heart. And I believe that most of you, the vast majority of you listening today, will agree with this statement. The best context for training, for disciplining, for raising and nurturing young children is the home. The best. And in that home, you would have a father and a mother who love each other and love their children and understand that one of their prime tasks in life is to nurture those children. Now, sometimes, of course, most of the time, the father has to be outside the home a good portion of the day working. And that would leave the mother in the home with the kids, the child or the children. But we know that that picture is often very complicated now by the fact that for one reason or another, many mothers are outside the home. And so children, rather than being raised and nurtured with the kind of solitary and focused attention that would come in the home in which they are there with their parents and their siblings, is now instead this process is taking place in a larger pattern, an institutional context, where there are paid people giving the care, and it's in the context of many other children with many other needs, and the attention and the focus and the care and the nurture, it's a very different experience altogether. Instead of having the intimate, focused attention that would take place in the home, you have an institutionalized setting. Now, immediately, I would have some people who say, you know, to even raise this issue is just to heap guilt upon people who find themselves in a situation in which their kids must be in daycare or in preschool or whatever. I want to challenge that on two levels. Number one, I can't tell you right now that I know that I can speak to your situation with full understanding. All I can say is, I think it's our responsibility to do everything within our power to try to meet this model, because God has intended for parents to have this responsibility and has given moms that primary gift of nurturing, and we need to aim for that. Secondly, where we can't meet that for one reason or another, the worst thing we can do is act like it doesn't matter. At the very least, we should understand that this raises the level of our responsibility to make certain that those kids who are in an institutionalized setting have the kind of attention that they need from the home and from the church to help make up for what they don't have all during the day. Like I told you, we're in controversial territory. I think this particular article in the New York Times is a wake-up call of sorts. If there are 5,000 kids being expelled from preschool, you're talking about young children, if their antisocial behavior, that's their word for it, if their nurture and discipline is breaking down to the point that the expulsion rate for preschoolers is three times that for school children, something tells me the problem is more than that these preschools are being overloaded with academic expectation. I think institutionalized settings are not the place where these young children are most likely to thrive. And I think that's the root issue. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I'd love to know what you think about this. How would you answer the question that is posed by the New York Times? What do you do about the fact that there is such a high expulsion rate of kids in preschool programs? What explains it? What would you do about it? What alternatives would you provide? What is the root issue you would identify? 877-893-8255 is the phone number, 877-893-TALK. It's time that we as Christians have a responsible, calm, clear, and convictional discussion about this. Nothing less than the lives of our children are at stake. Yes, we're living in a postmodern age in which so many things have happened. The family has been through so many transformations. The consumerist culture, the economic realities, the vocational realities all mean that this picture has become rather complicated and blurry for a lot of families. The issue is what we're going to do about it, and I'd love to hear from you. 877-893-8255. I can tell you the switchboard's lighting up as I expected. We're going to have a lively discussion. We'll be right back to see what you have to say. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This issue of preschool daycare, institutionalized child care, it affects millions of families across this country, and that includes a lot of Christian families. And I'm going to go back to what I said earlier. I think a lot of churches, a lot of Christian leaders, Christian teachers, just stay away from this issue because we're all afraid of stepping on somebody's toes or hurting someone's feelings. And the last thing we want to do in the case of a family that's just doing its very best to, just to keep its head above water is to make them feel guilt over just the fact that they aren't yet in an optimal position. But, you know, I think the other side of that is, unless we know what we're aiming for, we won't possibly get there. And I think a part of what we need to do as churches, as congregations, is to help families, especially young families, to get there and to address these issues honestly. I think institutionalized child care is a problem, period. At its very best, it isn't the optimal picture. At its worst, it can be a real disaster. So we as Christians really need to think this kind of thing through, and we need to understand that the responsibility of parents is simply huge. It's unspeakable, incalculable. But I think you know that already. Let's go to Michelle calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Michelle, go right ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to tell you I enjoy your show. I listen to it every evening on my way home from work.
Well, thank you.
I am a working mother. My husband and I both work, and our 18-month-old daughter is in daycare, and I find that I struggle with that almost every day when I drop her off. I guess my concern is, how do you get to the point based on the economy? I mean, the way that the expenses are and things like that, it's very hard to get to a point where I could go without working. You know, my husband and I, we drive extravagant cars. We've paid cash for our cars. They're not beautiful, but they run. And I guess, you know, we live very mildly. We live in a small home. I guess my question is, do I need to get in order to be able to stay at home with my child? Because I do struggle every day, and I hate it.
Michelle, bless your heart. And I have to say, I really respect your call. And I was particularly moved by your honesty about what it's like to drop off, you know, that child every day. And I think that just bespeaks your mother's heart. And there's something really, really precious about that. And your question is honest. And I want to be equally honest in response. I don't think it's possible for me to say to you, look, you need to go with one car rather than with two. You need to do this rather than that. Because you and your husband, before God, are going to have to work that out in a way that you know you can really live with. And I do not minimize for a moment the difficulty faced in this kind of economic situation. I mean, you're just looking at the cost of insurance and health care and food and shelter and all the rest. That's enormous. Just to have a car with insurance and to keep the lights on, those are significant costs. And those of us who are able to do that on one income, we ought to be very, very thankful that God has given us that opportunity. The other side of this is that I appreciated your real candor when, Michelle, you talked about your cars and your house and all the rest. I think there are some families who really have an inflated idea of what would be necessary. In other words, their minimal standard is higher than one income can fulfill. Now, here's a dirty little secret about our economic context. For most of American history, certainly throughout the early 20th century until the last, say, 20 years of the 20th century, the American economic model was on a single wage earner home in which it was assumed that it was going to be a father, a husband who was going to be working, and employers were expected to pay what was known in economic circles as a family wage. And so that was very, very important. It was a capstone of the economy. If you were an auto worker, or if you were a technician, or if you were a doctor, or, you know, almost anything, the standard wage was a family wage. Some people, like the doctors and the lawyers and the professionals, they made more than a family wage. But employers were understood to have a responsibility to make certain, whether they were Ford or GE or the local plumbing company, that they paid a family wage. Well, the rise of feminism and the change of the economy in terms of equal access, men and women and all the rest, means that employers no longer feel it is their responsibility to pay a family wage. And we are all of us, bearing the economic consequences of this. Every major social change comes as a two-edged sword, and feminism came along demanding equal rights for women, and there were many economic issues in which women were unfairly disadvantaged. But on the other side of that, what we now have is the expectation that it's no longer a husband or a father who has responsibility to provide for a family. It's a bunch of economic free agents. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. A fascinating discussion, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. You know, Michelle asked a very good question. You know, what should we do in situations like this? Let me just offer a couple of concrete suggestions. Number one, figure out as husband and wife what you really have to have and how this really has to work, and if there's any way you can get to a different picture. You know, if there's a different arrangement that can be made in the husband's workplace, in the home that would help get to that picture, because there's no doubt this is something that can't be turned around in 24 hours or maybe even 24 months for some families, but in a longer-term pattern. The second thing is optimize the care of the children in such a way that you minimize the institutional. And, and I'm sure Michelle and her husband have already thought this through, but, you know, is there some way that the number of hours the child is in an institutional setting can be reduced? Is there some work schedule change that can be made for both husband and wife, mother and father, that could help help arrange that? That'll make a big difference. And the third thing I would offer is this. Is there a non-institutional opportunity for the child care? Is there a grandmother? Are there grandparents? Are there relatives nearby who can really help with this? Because that is a far different situation. Because, that is something that we also need to mention in terms of an historical change. In America in years past, the extended family would have been there largely to help. There was a far larger social network that was involved here. And, of course, with modern mobility and all the rest, you have parents, children, extended family living thousands of miles apart sometimes. And this is one of the fallout aspects of all that. We simply don't have the support system we used to have. Appreciate the call from Michelle. Let's go to Mark calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Mark, go right ahead.
Dr. Miller, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to share some of my personal experiences. I've had experiences on kind of both sides of this issue and thought maybe that would help. And it was kind of timely for my family because my oldest, my daughter, who spent the first 4 to 5 years of her life in daycare, is graduating from high school tomorrow, and she's graduating as a valedictorian and has not given us one bit of trouble and is incredibly mature spiritually. Now, having said all that, after we had our second child, and we had our children while we were young, my wife approached me, and we started talking about her not going into work and her being at home, and we worked it out, and I was a little bit nervous about it, being kind of conservative financially, a little bit careful and cautious in that scenario, but she helped convince me, and it was the best move we ever made, and she was able to do some work at home, so she still generates some income, but has great flexibility to be there for, when they get home from school, things like that, and I really think it can work in both situations. It comes down to you have to put the energy and the effort and the time and the love into parenting when you are there.
Yeah.
And we did that with both, and neither have given us really any trouble.
Well, Mark, that's a great word of testimony and a very compelling personal experience you relate there. And I want to say, first of all, congratulations to you, your family, especially your daughter, who's going to be graduating as valedictorian tomorrow. That is a signal achievement, a great hallmark in her life. And I appreciate your honesty about having tasted both sides of this equation and an understanding that you could make adjustments in order to get from one picture to another, and yet also to understand that wherever you are in this, there are some steps you can make through serious parenting to really try our very best to make certain we're meeting the needs of our kids. I appreciate that call, Mark. Let's go to Joyce calling from Horsehead, New York, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Joyce, go right ahead.
Hi, Albert. Thank you for taking my call. I have been greatly impressed with both Michelle and Mark's comments and, of course, your suggestion. Having raised three children who are now grown and have children of their own and being their grandmother, I speak from experience. I also was able to stay home with my three children, although I was a school teacher by training. I had taught in kindergarten. I had witnessed for myself the cost of having children in an environment where they were structured all the time and away from their parents, and I knew our family needed that. In order to help these young families come up with a solution, I was feeling, as a Christian, a strong need for us to do mentoring. Those of us who have seen the positive impact of investing those five critical years when the children are 0 to 5 with our children, looking back now, of course, that seems like such a little bit of time, but when you're going through it, I know in Michelle's case it's monumental. It feels like you just have to be out there in the workplace to earn the money. We as mature Christians should take it upon ourselves to mentor the young families, to sit down and realistically evaluate their personal needs, their personal budgeting, help them to look at their expectancies, perhaps help them to reevaluate. Is this an unrealistic expectancy? For example, yeah. I'm sitting right now off the side of the road at the Outback restaurant, and it's 6:15 Eastern Standard Time here, and this parking lot is so full I'm actually parked in the grass because there's no room in the parking lot. Why is that? Because, unfortunately, our culture is setting a different standard than it was even 20 years or 25 years ago when I was raising my children. So if we could sit and mentor these young families and help them realize, you know what, come on over to our house for dinner, and let's talk about how we can help you get away from the cycle you're in of endless spending, endless demand, and then very patiently and lovingly guide these families.
Joyce, hold on just a minute. I really appreciate this. Let me just ask, in your local church, do you have this kind of ministry there in New York?
No, we absolutely do not have this kind of ministry. And I am now, of course, as you can hear, feeling very convicted that the Lord had me listen to this broadcast for maybe that specific reason. We have a very strong outreach church, and they do an incredible amount of ministry outreach, but this is not one of the things that we offer. We offer some financially counseling through the Larry Burkett series, and I think that's wonderful, but most people are highly intimidated by that and afraid to approach people with their finances. But
yeah.
If an older couple mentored and befriended, even if each of us took one family under our wing, for even a 30-day or a 3-month period, what a blessing.
Well, I think you've convinced me, Joyce. I think that mentoring idea is really, really important. That's what I was talking about in terms of congregational responsibility. And I think that's exactly what you would find, for instance, in Titus 2, where you have the older women helping the younger women, and also where you would have the same thing on the side of the men. And I like your idea of couples. I think that's really important. A lot more is at stake here than just sociology and psychology and educational development. We as Christians have to be responsible for what we as parents are to do in ordering our homes by Scripture, not just to produce healthy children, but to show the glory of God. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Mohler Program. Well, the switchboard tells the story. There were more people who wanted to talk about this than we could possibly get to in an hour. And this has started a conversation. I can assure you we are going to continue. We're going to continue to think this through from biblical and Christian perspectives and from the principles that are really set forth to show God's glory in the right ordering of the family. But we're going to take one final caller. Jennifer's calling from New Albany, Indiana. Jennifer, welcome. All right. Well, we lost Jennifer there at the very end. I was afraid of that. But Jennifer wanted to ask the question, what about single mothers? And she was calling as a young widow. And I wanted to take her call in order to make this point. We find ourselves in situations of brokenness, of loss. And like Jennifer, if she is indeed a young widow herself, something that wasn't her doing at all. And I want to suggest there are two wrong things we can do in response to that. Number one is ignore the obvious, and that is that a young woman, a young mother in that situation has challenges that others do not face. It would simply be wrong as a matter of etiquette to deny the obvious. And the second thing we need to be reminded of here is that we as the body of Christ bear a responsibility for each other. Where is the church in this? That's what I'd like to know. Where is the church? Where is the body of Christ to say, here is a young woman, a young mother, a young family that really needs our help? Where is the church to say, we need to take responsibility? You know, the New Testament is very clear that a man who will not provide for his own family is to be treated as worse than an unbeliever. That's one side of the equation. But the other side of that equation is the church's responsibility to take care of the weak, to take care of those who are in need, in Christian love and in the fulfillment of Christian responsibility, to reach out to strengthen each other, to encourage each other. In the bonds of Christian love and in mutual accountability to the Word of God, how is it that we're encouraging, helping, assisting each other? If there is a young mother in your church, a single young mother who's struggling with her children, it's not merely her problem, folks. It's the church's problem. It's the congregation's problem. It's our problem. If there's a young family that needs help figuring all this out, that's our problem. If there's a young dad or a young mom trying to figure out, how in the world am I going to get through this? How am I going to fulfill this responsibility? How am I going to make it in this economy, in this workplace, and in all the rest? That's not just his problem. It's not just her problem. It's our problem. The Church of the Lord Jesus Christ is supposed to be visible in local congregations that order themselves together in such a way that it's no longer an I and a you. It's we. These are our problems, our burdens, our responsibilities, and working through these problems is our privilege to see and to show the glory of God in the midst of creation. Folks, if the church really lived like that, the world would hear our witness in a very different way. Remember, Monday is Memorial Day. Help your family to understand what that's all about. We'll be back next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmuller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmuller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.